Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And we are on page 11 of 14 on Madison's notes on nullification. And so I recognize that there is a lot of, a lot of information that Madison really goes through. And as a matter of fact, I will say that when you get down well past half, he starts providing and diving into a level of analysis that, to me, it could easily confuse people because he starts talking about other states without really talking about what state he's talking about. So in other words, it gets a little ambiguous that I believe who the recipient only understands, you know, what he's saying, or there's got to be some side notes or what have you. But anyway, I still say that this is one of the most important documents that we have, because this is where he, the word ad nauseum, you get to a point where you're kind of sick of hearing this because he's just going on and on and on. And they go, which, Paul, welcome back. And so I think we still have Paul
Thank
with
you.
Us. Yeah.
So, I'm here.
So here's the question. Understanding Madison's prowess in writing and being succinct and to the point, this document is unlike any other Madison document because he just goes on and on and on and on. See my point? So why is it that he's taking so much time and analysis? I mean, he repeated himself, and then he went into this analysis that kind of took us down the sidetrack of how they were trying to disprove and, you know, this denial with it. Anyway, and now he's back to getting into the ultimate resort of what has to happen. And so this is where we ended off regarding the ultra-constitutional interpositions.
So when did he write these?
1834.
Okay, so he was approaching 80, I believe. So one, he was older. Two, he'd put a lot of effort in this, and he doesn't want to see it unravel. And so I'm guessing, GR, that he's giving this everything he's got.
Yeah. So he's at a point, I don't know how his health is at this point, because we knew he had health problems and, you know, throughout his life. Who knows, you know, how debilitated he may have thought that he was going to die tomorrow. I don't know. But he wanted to make sure he was completely clear about this he actually uses that term, newfangled, in this document. You can look it up, this newfangled doctrine of nullification. And so I just think he really wants to set the record straight. So here's the question. What the heck happened? How did he write this document? Again, we kind of had this conversation before, but as we're looking at it and, you know, as you really see, you know, the magnitude and the effort that he put into this thing to make the record straight, how is it that these patriotic organizations, I mean, I could see the progressives taking this and making this, you know, some twisted, you know, perversion of what they want to do. And as, you know, as a matter of fact, maybe this is what's going to happen. I'm not pontificating at all, but maybe because, you know, how everything's going to play out in the last days is pretty, you know, I guess is well known, obviously, in heaven. And who knows, maybe Satan kind of sees that, you know, he knows what America, you know, the design of this Constitution, he knows the divine nature of it, that maybe he sees that America does actually get this point of waking up, and that down the road, as the if the states try to actually use Republic Review, then states like California and some of these other progressive states may try to leave the union,
mm-hmm.
and or try to use single state nullification, saying we're not going to bite. And actually, what they're talking about, because see, I remember having a conversation. I know you know Keith Broders.
Yeah.
Keith Broders basically said that at any point in time, a state could secede from the union. That's not true. The only time a state can secede from the union is when the Constitution is being violated. In other words, when the federal government is doing something they don't have the authority to do. But if the federal government, because he said that California, if we declare Republic Review and start pulling it back, this California could secede from the union. And I said, no, they can't. And he goes, yes, they can. And I said, no, they can't. They can't call out a violation of compliance. In other words, you can step away from the union if the federal government is violating, but if they're actually demanding compliance and getting everything back into shape and cutting off, all of the gravy train, entitlements, welfare, and all these other things, and California says, if you're not going to continue violating the Constitution, then we're leaving. They can't do that. And then he got it. He said, oh, I see your point. They actually can only leave when the contract is being violated. But when they're actually getting back into the framework of the Constitution and actually, doing everything in compliance, then if they try to secede, they really can't. That's cool.
Well, so what you're saying is if they try to secede when we're trying to be in compliance, then they themselves are violating the Constitution.
Yes.
Or are they?
So when if California wanted to secede because the federal government was demanding compliance of the Constitution and they want to actually rebel against it and continue doing things like allowing the invasion and all these other things to say, we want to go down this path and sever, they can't do that. You can't leave the union. When you've joined this union, you've committed yourself to this lifetime marriage of living under that Constitution and however it properly changes, but that's what you agreed upon. And the only time you can secede or get out of the contract is when the contract is being violated. Remember, they go through this painstaking thing that when even one part of the contract is violated, the entire thing is violated. But when you're getting back into compliance, full compliance of the Constitution, then it's actually conforming to the standards of the union. So trying to say, now I want to get out is actually, you don't have the contractual legitimate way of getting out from underneath the compact.
Okay. Here's a question that I know I would hear from some of my libertarian friends. Who's going to stop them and how?
So what would happen is if you had mutiny in a state against the union, then it would actually be the leadership that would be pulled in. In other words, those leaders who are committing treason to say we're taking the state away, because it's not like the state is arming itself. It is just the political leaders. So you just go in and you take them all and you kind of put it in conservatorship and you put people back into, you finally have elections and get the proper representatives and all of that type of stuff. But you would basically have to put them kind of in conservatorship.
Yeah, you probably have to identify the people who are violating the Constitution, uh-huh. right?
Yep.
And allow the people to choose new leadership or new representation.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
That's right. I mean, that's what you would do. You don't have to go in and march in with armies. What you basically do, because I'm telling you, the federal government today has more than adequate force to actually go in and arrest those who are actually trying to, because every citizen in that state has constitutional rights to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Gavin Newsom wants to continue to oppress his people, you know, they can actually go in and say, you can't be doing that because they're violating the supreme law of the land.
Yeah.
And so these guys would be arrested on treason and tried. And technically, the, you know, what's the punishment for treason? Hanging. And so, you know, have a few public hangings, and I think people would start getting the message. Sometimes that's what it takes, but let's go into 81.
So I am, by the way, my numbers are in sync with yours now.
Okay. And
okay, I found the problem.
You found the problem. Okay, yes. So you'll go into 80 then.
Okay. The main pillar of nullification is the assumption that sovereignty is a unit, at once indivisible and unalienable, that the states therefore individually retain it as they originally held it, and consequently that no portion of it can belong to the United States.
Okay, so when we look at this concept, this, the main pillar of nullification is the assumption that sovereignty is a unit at once indivisible and unalienable, that the states therefore individually retain it as they originally held it, and consequently that no portion of it can belong to the United States. When actuality, when you join the Union, you are delegating sovereignty to a general government.
But you are delegating specific.
Yes, precisely. That's why it is your responsibility. You know, you got to expect the kids to try to get away with something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to try to take authority. I mean, that's the, that is the typical behavior of an adolescent child.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to really reassert your authority over all things not delegated.
Okay.
Keep going.
But it is not the Constitution itself, necessarily the offspring of a sovereign. Oh, but is it not the Constitution itself, necessarily the offspring of a sovereign authority? What but the highest political authority, a sovereign authority, could make such a constitution? A constitution which makes a government which makes laws. Laws which operate like the laws of all other governments, by a penal and physical force on the individual subject to the laws, and finally laws declared to be the supreme law of the land. Anything in the Constitution or laws of the individual state notwithstanding.
Right. Okay.
You said right, okay.
Yeah.
There were so many abbreviations in here.
Hang on. There was a lot. There was. So it basically, he's saying that when you create this government and the Constitution delegating these powers, you know, the government is going to operate like all governments by a penal and physical force. In other words, we're taxing you and you have to pay. And if you refuse the tax, then we can come in and use force. Whiskey rebellion.
Okay.
Okay. And so if they're actually living within that, they can use force, but they can't use force to do something they don't have the authority to do. Or if they do use force, then this is where, if they don't have the authority, this is where you switch and you act. The parents have to stand up and go, I'm sorry, I've never given you the keys to my car. Give me those keys back. Okay. You don't have the right to drive my car.
Okay. Okay. And where does the sovereignty which makes such a constitution reside? It resides not in a single state, but in the people of each of the several states, uniting with those of the others in the express and solemn compact which forms the constitution. To the extent of that compact or constitution, therefore, the people of the several states must be a sovereign as they are a united people.
Right.
Okay.
So as Madison talked about, you know, it talks about we the people, and, you know, that when this Constitution was ratified, it was ratified by the people. right? Because the
people through their representatives, but correct. By the people nevertheless.
Correct. But actually, he misses one element here.
And Madison?
Yes, and shame on James.
What do you mean?
Because when you break down the ratification debates, this is a nuance because, again, they didn't think much about the counties.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't apply this constitutional principle the way it should have been, or he would have actually, because he was the president for, 8 years. And as a matter of fact, he was the outgoing president when Indiana was coming in. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things that he probably just ignored and Congress got away with in the Enabling Act. He just probably didn't even pay that much attention. But bottom line, when we look at the states and the ratification, go through the ratification layout of how it was, passed in the proceedings of each state. It was done by county.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, every delegate voted, and those votes were registered by county. In other words, each county got so many different delegates to represent the population of that county. The more populated counties had more delegates.
Right.
But it was still done by county.
The counties.
That's right. That's right. So one of the things he says that it was actually done by the sovereignty of the people, it was the sovereignty of the people of the counties within that state.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't recognize the three different layers. In some respects, they marginalized. They stepped over this one principle in the Declaration of Independence that all governments are instituted by we the people.
Right.
That the principle of forming a government, it must be instituted by the people. Therefore, did the people not institute their counties? Yes, in all new states that joined the Union, the territory didn't become a state until you had so many counties with enough population and everything else. In other words, the initial government that was being instituted wasn't the territorial government, it was the county governments.
Mm.
Then the territorial government started forming, and then they started having elections because you can't have a territory and say, I'm the governor of this territory, and then everybody move in.
Sure.
Right. So you actually have to form, and then you start creating, your governing body of those people who are residing within the county. And what ends up happening is, as the counties form, they start electing possibly a governor, or maybe they called him a baron. I think it was all governors. But
okay.
Anyway, whatever they decided to call the head honcho of the county, because at that point in time, they didn't create a state legislature. It was just a bunch of independent counties that had, let's say, boards of supervisors, or let's have, today we call them commissioners, whatever. But the county had this very minimal governing.
Correct.
Very minimal. And for the most part, everybody marginalized it because government wasn't trying to get into everybody's britches. But the whole time we were expanding with this manifest destiny and growing these states, the federal government was crawling and creeping outside the Constitution, growing and assuming and usurping more power. Mm-hmm. Had they actually done what they were supposed to do from the onset, I don't think we would have ever come close to this brink. But I believe it was the machinations and the avarice of, these men that, were wielding this power.
Hmm. Okay.
And that, they just wanted to assume more power and assume more. Well, we're just going to assume these things. Why not? You guys don't need to. And actually, the more they assumed, the more pressing need, because these things were going to be levied upon them. They really did need to start getting organized. And, now's the time to wake up, folks. This is where we really have to start recognizing that the only way we're going to take back our state, because bottom line, everything he's saying here, everything Madison is pointing out regarding the union of the federal government, it is the same thing as the union of your state. Mm-hmm. You have counties that formed a union and in their sovereign capacity created this state government.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line, here's the real problem. You gave them more of an open-ended constitution than you should have. And now's the time to say, you know what? We need these powers back at the county level. And now we can truly function as a more proper republic.
Right.
And form a general government to serve us.
Okay.
That's the whole point of a general government. The federal government was to serve these 50 states. Sovereign states, right? And the state government should be serving the counties. And then eventually, and technically, there's no limit to counties, right? I mean, Georgia has almost 200 counties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's no limit. This, you know, you if you've got a big county with a big, like L.A., Seattle, San Francisco is kind of on top of each other, but right, you know, you can start subdividing and saying, you know what, you're going to become a county.
Right.
Yeah, and what that does is the more counties you have, the more county judges you have, the more common law courts you have. But you have to figure out what you want to make that sweet spot. Because now when you look at L.A., L.A. has 13 million people.
That's a county with twice the population of my
state. Yes, that's my point. So in other words, we actually have to start, you know, paring down and allowing a more proper representative government, because I'm telling you, though, the Board of Supervisors of L.A., these guys are mini tyrants.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're all, this is how government all, you know, in the back doors and in the dark, dank rooms are selling out their people to the globalist agenda and all these lobbyists.
Right.
There is no allowance in this country under this constitution for lobbyists to basically steal away your suffrage. They're not entitled to suffrage. And what do I mean by suffrage? Your representatives, when they're in session, whether it is a county government, state government, or federal government, they are there to represent you. And when they actually are doing the representation of those who actually have no dog in the fight in that county. I mean, many of these things that are coming down from on high are coming from outside that county.
Right.
The lobbyists, they're operating out of some conglomerate, most of them even foreign, like this Agenda 3030.
Right.
So my point is that, folks, you have to learn that you have to take back your county. And as a matter of fact, you know, in many big cities, you're going to have to subdivide. You have to. There's way too much collective power. Or you build a whole new county capital that's bigger than, you know, the national capital.
You're right.
But you don't need to build them so big anymore, because we've learned that we have, we have this virtual, you know, the technology. You don't have to put everybody into this physical place or space. Does that make sense?
Yes. Sure
does. So what I'm basically saying, folks, go ahead.
No, that's what I was saying when I referred to Moses, just what you just talked about with breaking up the counties. But go ahead.
Yeah. So the whole point is that you can maintain a large county today. You can, but you have to break up. You got to make sure that you're being fairly represented. And when I say fairly represented, we're going into break. But what I'm really trying to say here, and folks will be right back after the break, but what I'm really trying to say is that, you know, the framers felt that 30,000 people could barely be represented by one person. And when you got 13 million people represented in a county by a handful of 5, 6, 7, I mean, that's terrible. That's even worse than Congress. And so we have to actually start looking at apportionment. We'll be right back after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one of the things I had learned a long time ago, and as a matter of fact, I heard John Charleston repeat it like a mantra, but, you know, this is an old saying, keep it small, keep it all. In other words, if you keep control held by a small group of people, then you can, you know, control people and maintain that control. Which is one of the reasons why, and this became really evident as a mantra within the party, which is one of the reasons why is the party at the county level, they don't want to get it too big. They don't want every precinct to have representation. Why? Because it's harder to control the county.
You know, I've actually seen that year.
Yeah. Right. And as a matter of fact, when you have people that are involved, you know, and so here, see, the problem with the Constitution Party is you may only have one person in every county. If you're lucky, you may have two or three or four, you know, at the most, I don't know. I mean, a good county might have quite a few. I think Spokane County, the Libertarian Party, I think they had like about 20 members, about 20, but they weren't really active. They didn't have committees. It was really more of a social hour. You know, they'd meet at a pub, you know, and kind of do their business and then have a few drinks. And okay, that's kind of what it was. And so my point is that for you to have a truly representative government, for you to have a real self-government, you have to have everybody at the precinct level represented. So if you look at how our government is broken down, you know, you have the county, and then you have districts within the county, then you have the smallest sub-element, which is the precinct. Mm-hmm. And a precinct is 1,500 people, and a precinct is represented by one person.
Right.
The framers were very, very cautious of trying to have one person represent anything greater than 50,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was mind-bending for them to think that a person could actually go into a legislative body and represent more than 50,000 people, because the needs of the people would be drowned out by those who had more affluence.
Right.
And that's what happens. That is precisely what happens when you go down the path of having a person representing a large body of people, because those who are the richest, those who produce the most oil, get the most movement.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, let you keep going on, because we were talking about, you know, subdividing counties and so forth, and fixing apportionment and or representation at the county level. So you have to keep that in mind. So keep going.
Okay. I think we're at 84.
Are you sure?
I can read 83 again. Let me see. Okay, let me start 83.
Okay. Yeah, I think so.
In like manner, the constitutions of the states made by the people are separated into states, were made by a sovereign authority, by a sovereignty residing in each of the states, to the extent of the objects embraced by their respective constitutions. And if the states be thus sovereign, though shorn of so many of the essential attributes of sovereignty, the United States, by virtue of the sovereign attributes with which they are endowed, may to that extent be sovereign, though destitute of those attributes of which the states are not shorn. Okay, I hadn't read this one.
That's right. I didn't think so.
Help me.
Yeah, so...
This is another hard one for us.
So, I don't think you read 82. So, read 82 because that one might be hard. Because the last one you read was the one with all the acronyms, which was 81.
Okay. Oh, you're right. Okay. 82. And where does the sovereignty which makes such a constitution reside? It resides not in a single state, but in the people of each of the several states, uniting with those of the others in the express and solemn compact which forms the Constitution. To the extent of that compact or Constitution, therefore, the people of the several states must be a sovereign, as they are a united people. I think I did read this, but
okay,
it was good
but,
to do
but
it again.
Yeah, you're right. So it is sovereign and united in sovereignty.
Correct.
Okay. And I think that's what he's trying to say. But he's, again, and this is where I kind of point out that I think Madison lost sight of an essential element within the county. There is no government is formed that is not necessary.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
No government
should be formed that is not necessary.
No,
right?
I'm just saying we do not create governments that are not necessary.
That's the ideal.
Well, we create bureaucracies. Government creates bureaucracies that are not necessary. That's how tyranny reigns. But when we, the people, have a government created, it serves a purpose. And to marginalize the county in these days, it was only done because government was only involved in these very fine or defined aspects of our lives.
Correct.
They did not control whether you could buy a bad potion or not. You know, mm-hmm. If you bought something that was absolutely worthless, were you entitled to your money back? No. You spent the money. You know, a fool and his money are often parted, right?
Right.
And so, you know, government wasn't there to basically, you know, underwrite your mistakes and to say, okay, we'll fix your owie. We're, you know, oh, you got yourself, you know, you got a bad disease. We'll fix that. Government was not designed to do any of that.
Well,
this is where churches fit in.
Well, not only that, government wasn't designed to tell you what kind of light bulbs you're supposed to buy or how many gallons
of
water
Madison, by maintaining a look upstream, didn't look downstream, and that's my point. He marginalized an existing government that was created for a very specific purpose, because where is it that we sought and received justice? We received justice at the county. That was the first place when you were being harmed, you would go to the county court and say, hey, you know, this guy's stealing my property. This guy took my horse or what have you.
Well, excuse me, did he marginalize it or did he just take it for granted? Because
he's not mentioning it. So I think he's not mentioning it at all because so by this point in time, how many states had formed into the Union?
Let's see. What year was this?
This
1830 something. So I think probably 20. I know. No, I can look. So I think, let's see, states by date. Let me take a look. So we are looking at a list of states by admission to the Union, and if we look by date, we've got, stop that.
You're gonna find this interesting.
Okay, so by 1836, we had 20. Arkansas was in 1836. When was this written?
1834. 34, right. So Missouri was the last state coming into the Union.
State.
Yeah.
Right.
And that means that there were 24 states in the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And so when, you know, at this point in time, and the reason, why did I ask you that? Because if you add up how many states had joined the Union by this time, it had been 11. And by this time,
right.
by this time, they had gone through the process of mm-hmm. forming each state by the counties in the same application. In other words, the counties formed and sent delegates to create their state.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they were replicating the process, but and actually they were creating general governments, but they didn't have the eye single to containing those governments and those general governments, because Madison marginalized, you know, government in our everyday lives and thinking that, you know, the state general government was more than adequate for governing people. But now we can see that when we've grown to such sizes where you mm-hmm. have population centers that, you know, overwhelm. I mean, L.A., you know, take the amount of people that live in L.A. and look at I could probably create a nice list of Montana, Wyoming, both Dakotas, and start going down into, you know, how many states would the state of L.A. populate?
Sure.
Right. The state of L.A., but it's not a state, it's a county.
The quick question, isn't it possible to create, well, sure it is, to create two states out of one? I mean, there's a movement in Illinois.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and West Virginia. Actually, West Virginia separated itself from Virginia due to the Civil War.
So West Virginia wasn't a territory.
West Virginia became a state, and this is how, you know, it basically became a state, was on the onset of the Civil War.
Wow. I didn't. There it is, 35, June 20th, 1863.
Right. Because those people in West Virginia didn't want to have anything to do with the war. They were dragged into something they didn't want to have a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one of the reasons why, you know, West Virginia was actually formed outside of, because the state legislature, it says right there in the Constitution that no state shall be formed without the legislature, you know, of the state approving. Well, the state legislature didn't approve that to happen. They just said, hey, we want to be a part of the United States. So West Virginia was formed under the Union as a state separate from Virginia. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but it sounds, what you're describing sounds like they went outside the constitutional process.
Well, so at that point in time, was Virginia part of the Union?
Well, sure it was. It was one of the 13 original states.
No, it seceded. It seceded. It wasn't in the Union. So
wait a minute. So what you're saying is the counties in West Virginia,
yes,
created a state and then joined the Union.
Yes. Or they basically made the appeal to say we want to be admitted into the Union, and then they formed their state. Yes.
That is unique.
Yeah. It kind of points out to, one, how we could be doing this to China, how we could be doing this to the Ukraine. You know, every nation that is under tyranny could easily be appealed to and say, you know, we will prepare you. It may take a long time due to the language, law, monetary, all of these barriers, but we will, you know, prepare you and help you, you know, on your path to becoming a sovereign state in the United States, but you have to become a territory first.
So if Taiwan wanted to be a state.
Yes, yeah, Taiwan could, and it wouldn't be Taiwan itself. It would have to be the counties or the sub-elements of Taiwan that would make that appeal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And technically, I guess it could be Taiwan, but they would have to have an election because you can't have a monarch drag people. This has to be self-destiny. Sure. So you need to have a majority of the counties. We are the sub-element of government, whatever they call them in Taiwan. I don't believe Taiwan is, maybe it is, because their culture is different. They don't have this sovereignty concept, but they would need to have an election, and they really need to be subdivided and so forth. And so bottom line, that's all they got to do is just apply themselves to say, do we want to become a part of the United States? And voila. Just like that, as soon as they make the appeal to say, we want to become a state, here's the evidence of our election, we the people of the state of Taiwan want to become a state in the United States, and then it begins. They become a territory, and we basically go in and put, forts and all of these, fortifications to defend them, and, absolutely.
And then, guess what? We have a reason to be there. Right now, we don't.
Oh, yeah. Right? And just imagine the smell of the air coming across those straits. Yeah. You would smell the fear in China. Because, see, China would actually see this as not just an external threat, but an existential threat, because it is a threat that would actually cause other provinces within China to actually stand up and say, we want to be a part of the United States as well.
So imagine what we missed, because, now we have China coming to South America when we had an opportunity. Ron Paul wrote a book called The Foreign Policy of Freedom, and he sent me a signed copy. Okay, and it was a collection of his talks in Congress. It's like a voice in the wilderness, saying the right things and no one's listening to him. But I think what he may not have understood was that a foreign policy of freedom isn't for us to be the world's policeman, but for us to be the beacon of freedom. Hey, by the way, South America, Argentina.
So Ron Paul, the thing I didn't like about Ron Paul is, he almost adopted the idea that only we should be free and leave everybody else alone. That, the land of liberty was based upon the specific longitude and latitudes on this sphere where this nation resided, instead of all nations should be, come into the land of liberty. Right. What you're saying is the beacon of liberty.
I don't think anyone understood that. I don't think anyone understood the idea that.
But Reagan kind of touched upon it. But he didn't implement a policy that would have actually, tilted the world.
Sure. And so what we might have had, and if we clean up our house, what we might have is this foreign policy of freedom, is that we invite other nations to join the nations of the United States. We have another name, another thing we could call ourselves. We could call ourselves the United Nations of America. It essentially means the same thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
But
they chose states, so that's what we stick with.
Right. They chose states, but in terms of what it means, if we were to get that concept, and the people, we don't have that concept. It's been baked out of the psyche, and we need to return that understanding. I guess that's what I'm saying. Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Where'd I leave off?
So you, we're on 84 now.
Okay. Such is the political system of the United States de jure and de facto, and however it may be obscured by the ingenuity and technicalities of controversial commentators, its true character will be sustained by an appeal to the law and the testimony of the fundamental character. It looks like he continues there.
Uh-huh.
Whereas a system formed by the people as one community would, on its dissolution, throw the people into a state. I've got a couple questions here.
Yeah.
Okay. What does he mean by its dissolution? Whereas a system formed by the people as one community would on its dissolution
throw the
people into
keep reading.
Okay. And a just inference from a survey of this political system is that it is a division and distribution of political power. Nowhere else to be found a nondescript to be tested and experienced by itself alone, and that it happily illustrates the diversified moderations of which the representative principle of republicanism is susceptible with a view to the conditions, opinions, and habits of particular communities. Again, and I do this for our audience, this probably needs a translation.
So it starts off with 85 and it kind of goes through to 86. And he talks about this political system of this de jure facto United States government that, you know, we kind of obscure the ingenuity and the technicalities regarding, you know, this. And I'll just go back to these commentators that he's kind of pointing to, the nullifiers, have, you know, tried to create a one-to-one relationship, you know, single state to the federal government, when that's not the design. It's a one to the many, and then the many to the one. And correct. I've said this, one state to the union, and the union to the federal government. It's not one, you know, state to the federal government. That is not the relationship. That is not the union. That is not the compact. It is a state joining with the other states into the compact, one to the many. And then that compact to the federal government. And so he's trying not to, you know, allow these things to be marginalized and to actually be misrepresented, because this is why he kind of talks about nowhere else to be found a nondescript to be tested and experienced by itself alone. And it happily illustrates the diversified moderations of which the representative principle of republicanism is susceptible. So I think I don't want to say he's talking in theory. He's just talking in this generality of how you have these unique makeups of these different Republican governments within this Republican government. Are not states Republican in form? Is not the union as the United States a Republican form of government as well?
It should be.
Therefore, when we look at the states being Republican in form, we have to look at the states being like the federal government that is a general. I mean, I've actually seen this where I don't think he saw it. I don't think he was talking to it, but he didn't talk about the significance of the counties within the states and how unique even those forms of government, and how this just is a perpetuating government to allow liberty let me just stop and take a better approach to this. Okay. Political energy in America flows to the people. It doesn't flow to the federal government. We give to the federal government what is necessary, but all political energy is kept at the local level, and then we give a little bit to the state, and the state gives a little bit that we give to them to the federal.
Would you say it flows from the people?
So like in other words, when we look at there's two types of energies. When I talk about the flowing of energy in motion, there is centrifugal and centripetal. There are two opposing types of energies. Mm-hmm. Centrifugal is outward flowing. In other words, as the object spins, everything goes out to the people. Centripetal is inward drawing. In other words, from the many to the one. From the outside to the center. It draws everything into the center. Two types of energies like that is if you look at the universe is, you know, just like a galaxy is exploding outward. That energy is flowing outward. if you look at the atom, the energy is drawing inward, maintaining and keeping that atom into its form. And to change that atom requires energy to drop out an ion and a neutron to literally change it from iron to gold or what have you, right?
Okay.
Adding ions and neutrons, whatever. I mean, that's metallurgy, right?
Okay.
But the point is, and I think that what he's talking about is really, it's really more of, I'll just say, kind of an editorialized, glossy picture that's just hard for people to kind of get. But to me, I honestly see that even Madison isn't getting and understanding the importance down within the state. He sees the states as the end, but it's not. The county governments are the end. And actually, I don't think we need to create counties within counties. I just think that we split counties and grow the state by counties, or actually grow the union of the state, not the state, but they grow the union. To keep it in context, the way he's talking here, it is, again, the one to the many and the many to the one, and it's the same thing within, you know, the state. We, you know, when we actually, you know, get to a point where you have too many people in a county, then we need to subdivide that so that there is adequate representation, you know, because you don't want to have, I mean, it's 13 million in a county is absolutely ridiculous.
It's way too much. We've got about a minute and a half left. There are two things that stood out for me, and maybe we can cover them, you know, next trip. But the first one is, I was thinking of centrifugal force and centripetal force differently. In other words, with centrifugal force, the energy comes out from the people, okay?
No. So the energy flows out to the people. In other words, if you are holding a glass of water and you actually, as you're spinning around, you're containing that water into a container. If you actually flip the container so that it allows that water to go outward, it actually goes out. It goes out to all points around you, all points around.
In other words, the influence of the people goes outward.
Outward, closer to the people. It's distributed, right? It's going out to the people.
We should discuss that one. The other thing that I wanted to share before we run out of time is that he uses the term in one sentence, which are trigger words for the drill assembly people. And that is, he starts out by saying the system of the United States de jure and de facto. And this is, I don't know what he is saying here, okay? And I'm just...
There we go. So I get it. Paul, we'll have to, I'll highlight this. So next week, because I've got my interview with Mike McKibbins tomorrow. Next week, we will dive into it, starting off with paragraph 84. Folks, as you can tell, the counties are the center. That's the center for us locally. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.